This is Due by Friday, a weekly challenge podcast with Merlin Mann, Alex Cox, and Max Temkin. This week's challenge, pimp your drink. Is that Merlin on the line? Is Merlin here?
Oh. Yes, I'm here.
challenge?
Are you making fun of the Midwest accent, the Chicago accent?
I'm making fun of your accent.
Okay,
yeah,
you and Max
both have a silly accent. It's sweet. Big news. Big news. My
yes.
Sport peppers arrive soon.
Your sport?
Sport peppers. So I can make a slightly more legit Chicago dog.
Oh, okay. Cool. Oh, Max is here.
Hi, Max. Turn me up.
Just so you know, Max is pacing and cannot hear you.
That's fine. We can gossip about him. He likes that.
I know.
Why is he on speakerphone? What's happening? Why can't people just talk on the phone like a person, Alex?
Millennials.
I'll answer the question. It's millenniums, and I think it's because... God damn it, that's so loud. It's because of reality TV, where people talk into their phone like it's a slice of pizza. Chicago pizza.
Leave my package at the door.
Track a package. If that's not right, say go back.
Go back. Go back.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Leave my package at my door.
Try talking into the phone like a person.
Say your tracking number. It usually begins with a letter V. Or if you have an info notice, tell me the number near the barcode.
Yell the F word lots of times.
Or press zero.
No, but then you actually have to talk to a person.
1049-59-35-98-277-469. Nice.
I found your status. This package is out for delivery today. Drivers typically deliver between 9 a.m. and 8 p.m. unless the service selected.
She's talking to him like he's had a head injury.
Sorry,
are you
I didn't
okay?
get that. Do you want to hear this again? Please say yes or no.
Please leave my package at the door.
I still didn't get that. Would you like to hear about your package again? Press 1 for yes or 2 for no.
Please leave my package at the door. Leave it at the door.
One moment. I'll connect you to an agent.
Oh!
Oh.
Finally!
Hello, you're speaking with Robert UPS. No, Mr. UPS is my father.
All right. Well, welcome to Due by Friday. My friend Renato Mariotti, media personality, former federal prosecutor, expert on the possible emerging criminal conspiracy of the Donald
and
Trump
also
organization.
Max gifted Twitter threader. He's really good at threading his tweets.
Yes. How did we meet? Oh, through we met. We have a whole weird connection before you got into politics.
That is very true. I had dinner with you, and I remember. You and my friend were both talking about Twitter, and you know, you guys were discussing all the crazy stuff you did on Twitter. This is back when you bought like the gallon of, what was it like the multi-gallon drum of lube?
Yep. Uh-huh.
And I'm like, God, that's so weird that these two guys are spending so much time on Twitter. obviously now I'm the guy who is at dinner buried in my phone, and everyone's like, "What are you doing? Why are you? Why are they more interesting than us?"
Yeah, I remember that because that was when the militia guys had like were squatting in that nature preserve, and where was that in Oregon? And
Cliven Bundy.
That sounds right, and they were like. They were like, we forgot to pack snacks and we're hungry. So here's an address. Please send treats. And so I just went on Amazon and I found the most funny, unwieldy, like large like thing that I could buy, which was this industrial barrel of lubricant. And I had it delivered to them. And
then personal lubricant.
And then it popped up again in some sort of federal filing of like evidence collected from the site, and they were like recovered like one barrel of like lubricant.
Wow.
So that was funny. And then tell us about a little bit about, for our listeners who may not know you, first of all, Renato is a proud member, founding member of Max's political Twitter list, at Renato Mariotti on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, not that anyone could spell that, but yes.
You'll figure it out. And tell us about a little bit about your story. Tell us about how you became a federal prosecutor. And
wow.
Yeah.
So I was like this guy who kind of came from nowhere. My parents didn't even go to college. My dad didn't even graduate from high school. Went to University of Chicago, Yale Law School. Went to a big law firm, partially to help out my parents for a while. And I just didn't feel passionate about what I was doing at the time. Decided to become a federal prosecutor. Did that for a decade here in Chicago, or almost a decade. And I left. I figured, oh, I'll do something different. I was going to be turning 40. I did not think that I was going to be on Twitter or on television or doing podcasts. I thought I'd be in my office practicing law or in court. And I still do that. I'm a partner at a law firm here in Chicago, Thompson Coburn. But in my, quote, spare time, unquote, I talk a lot about political and legal issues all the time.
What is a federal prosecutor?
Federal prosecutor is a lawyer who represents the United States in not only in court, but you lead investigations. So you work with FBI agents, DEA agents, et cetera, to investigate crimes. You help them get search warrants and wiretaps and things like that. And then after that, you obtain indictments from grand juries, and then you ultimately go to court, and you go to trial if you need to, and you handle the case in court.
So what you handle is basically white collar crime, right?
Well, now or then.
Then, I
okay.
suppose.
So then I handled all different types of crime. So when you're a baby prosecutor, mm-hmm. they give you stuff that if you screwed up, it wouldn't be the end of the world. Although those simple, easy crimes are like bank robbery. So they're kind of like hard.
The normal ones.
Yeah, the normal ones. But in all seriousness, those are crimes where it's harder to screw up, or they're mm-hmm. more straightforward. And I handled everything. I mean, I went after drug cartels and kidnapping and child exploitation. But I was best known as a white collar mm-hmm. prosecutor. That's what I did for the bulk of my time there. And where I really got my expertise.
Can you sort of explain what exactly? Where's the barrier between bank robbing and white collar crime? I feel like that should be an easy question to answer. But I'm an internet ding-a-ling and couldn't figure
bank
it out
robbing,
on Google.
Bank robbing is the one that you get in trouble for in America.
Hi-oh.
Well, but wow, white collar is like a loose term that describes a variety of crimes. And typically mm-hmm. the idea there is they're crimes that are involved essentially with paper and words. They're not they tend to be nonviolent crimes. There's some that are fuzzy. Okay, I'll put in mm-hmm. a fuzzy area where, you know, is child pornography, you know, I would consider that not a white collar crime, even though that involves.
No, that's the people's crime. Anyone can do that.
Yeah, well,
it's very accessible.
Wow.
One.
I'm not gonna comment on that.
Well, my other question was.
It's one. It's one. You just simply download the Tor browser, and it's one search away.
Oh my God. We're backing up.
Moving on. But my point is. To give you an obvious example, a bank robbery is not a white collar crime. That's something. It's a crime of violence. You're scaring mm-hmm. these tellers, putting them in fear for their life. Embezzling money from a bank is white collar crime, and you get less time for that usually, ostensibly because of that lack of violence. But on the other hand, obviously, there's a racial disparity and economic disparity in terms of the type of people who commit those different types of crimes.
So I think everyone has about. Typically, Renato, I know you're a big Do By Friday listener, so I don't need to tell you this, but typically we kind of go through the week's news and we make fun of Trump a little bit. So I think we have some like current events we want to touch on.
I would never make fun of Trump or criticize him in any way.
Well,
I'm
that
really
would be
offended.
Unbecoming.
Yeah. I'm offended.
Yeah. And then I know personally, like the news is moving too fast for me to understand it right now. This is the thing I'm most excited to ask you about. So I am a little bit of, I don't know if you and I have really ever gotten into this. I'm a little skeptical of the sort of legal remedy to Trump. Like I'm a big believer in that we really need a political victory here, and that I don't know that I believe that the legal remedy is going to come through. I don't really know if it's going to stick. I'm a little, I don't know. I'm glad it's happening, but it's not a sure thing to me. Okay. So here's the first thing I want to know. Can you kind of explain the legal case against Trump at the federal case against Trump because collusion with the Russians is not a charge, right? I mean, it's
correct.
A bad thing that happened, it's politically problematic, but you can't charge someone with collusion. That's why Trump can say there's no collusion, because it's not disprovable, right?
Collusion is whatever anyone wants it to be. It's in the eye of the beholder, right? There's no definition of collusion out there.
So what are they going to charge with? Like, what is the charge here? Like, what's the legal case? Like, can you walk us through some scenarios there?
Yes, but before I get to your question, one thing I'm just going to note for people listening is there is a very big legal debate about whether a sitting president could be charged with anything at all. And to me, the bigger sense of skepticism that I have, which is maybe a little different than yours, is I am not convinced at all that Bob Mueller, even if he was absolutely sure that Donald Trump committed a crime, would indict him. I think he would present it to Congress.
Right.
And Congress, you know, you can decide whether the Republican Congress to do anything about it. It's outside of my area of expertise. But I will just say that, you know, for that reason, I am skeptical about a legal solution, but it's different than what you're saying. So I'll address your question now.
Well, you know, yeah, that's maybe we can get into can a president be charged with a crime, because it seems to me like from the Clinton press, it seems like Democratic presidents can be charged with crimes, but not Republican presidents. Like,
well, like, it's not like Bill Clinton was indicted. He was brought there was a report that was made to the House of Representatives, and actually Kenneth Starr had a memo
the Supreme Court said if it's not related to his duties as president, there's no
talking about Jones versus Clinton.
Yeah,
but that's
Clinton,
a civil
no, what's
lawsuit.
That, what's that thing called? There's no the Nixon defense. There's no immunity, right?
Mm-hmm. But that's different. It's not that those are all different questions. In Jones, what the question was is whether Clinton could get sued while he's in office. That's been decided. Then there's the question of whether or not, you know, executive privilege gives the president a shield from being subpoenaed, et cetera. It doesn't do that. The question that has never been addressed by court, because it's never come up, is can a sitting president be indicted? And it's really a question that would never be brought before a court, or could never be brought before a court, until a president was indicted. And the Justice Department has, you know, for years now had the conclusion, internal conclusion, that a sitting president can't be indicted. It's something that's hotly debated in legal circles. I'd say the majority of people think a sitting president can't, but their only real support for that, just to be clear, is the fact that the Constitution says a president can be impeached and doesn't talk at all about indictment or anything else. There's nothing magic.
The Constitution doesn't say I can be indicted. Does that mean I can't be indicted?
Right, exactly. My point is that what I'm trying to explain to everybody is there's not like there's some secret document out there, like, you know, George Washington penned some document that's in a safe that says that the president can't be. It's just what we infer from the Constitution itself. So for that reason, I'm skeptical that there's going to be an indictment in this case, and I've talked a little bit about that publicly already. But let's get to your question, which is, is there any there? One thing that I am convinced, and I've written a long piece about this a few months ago, is that there is an obstruction case against Donald Trump. If not for this issue that I just raised about could a sitting president be indicted, I would be absolutely convinced that Mueller would obtain an obstruction indictment, because the evidence of Donald Trump's corrupt intent is just so vast. And what I mean by the reason I'm using the word corrupt intent is not in the sense that I'm passing judgment on him being corrupt or not corrupt, but there's a statute that prohibits you from taking actions and that literally the word in there is to act corruptly in doing that. And what that means is that you have the intent to obstruct the investigation. So ordinary things you could do, like firing Comey, which he certainly has the authority to do if he thinks Comey's doing a bad job. If he's doing it with the intent to obstruct the investigation, that's against the law.
Right. What was the – Merlin, you had a great example on the podcast a couple of weeks ago where you were like, it's not illegal to shred a piece of paper, but it becomes illegal if the piece of paper is evidence in a you know, criminal conspiracy.
Right, right. Yeah. It seems like there's all kinds of things that – what's the phrase I think you just used, corrupt intent? That there's all kinds of things that are illegal to do unless you're doing it to cover something up.
Right. Yeah. It's not even merely you can even shred it if it is evidence. The question is what's your intent when doing it. And by the way, that gives you a window into why white collar crimes are so hard to prove. How do you prove what's going on inside someone's brain? I mean, it's not like you have a magic telescope that sees inside their brain. All these white collar cases involve using documents and emails and stuff to try to peer into somebody's mind. Now, so let's move back to your question.
It's like some sort of like H.P. Lovecraft thing if they could do that to Trump. It's like you'd go yeah. insane. It's like gazing into the
circus
eyes of the old ones.
Yeah, that'd be scary.
You'd go insane. You'd come out like a bumbling moron.
Just mumbling Eldritch horror. Oh, God.
You know, one thing, you know, that brings up an important point. In science fiction, they never seem to use these like empaths or telepaths in trials. Have you noticed that? Right?
Thank you.
Yeah, you go. We had Star Trek The Next Generation. We had these big trials, famous trials. It's not like they had Counselor Troy kind of off to the side, sitting there like telling us whether or not the witnesses were telling the truth. So underutilized.
It's a particular kind of nerd who watches Next Gen and then looks at all the science fiction and goes, I wonder how this would affect the court proceedings. They do have a crazy like martial form of law. Like whenever you see a court case in Star Trek, it makes no sense. Like there's total like miscarriage of justice for dramatic purposes in every trial that they have in the Federation.
Well, I will say I can't watch any legal kind of TV show without just it. It's totally ruined for me. I cringe when I watch it because it's ruined for me because I'm sitting there pointing out all the flaws. I mean, even The Wire is an amazing television show. It's one of the best I've ever seen. But I had already obtained wiretaps before I watched The Wire. I had already investigated narcotics cases, much bigger scale ones, like more like the guys who were the Greek guys who are bringing it off the boat than the people that were being investigated in The Wire. But nonetheless,
business, always business.
Yeah, there you go. But nonetheless, I'd be watching and I'd be like, oh, that's not right. Or what about this or that? You know, it's inevitable.
But you feel it's fair to say Data didn't really get a fair trial.
Hey, you know what? He it went in his favor, right?
So. Is this what is known as poker face? Are we going to talk about Michael?
Let's all go around and say our favorite Next Generation episodes.
Oh, I like the one where he goes away and learns to play the flute. I like that.
All right. I mean, let's just get into the fun stuff now. So, Merlin, do you want to...
We ate our legal vegetables.
Counselor, do you want to...
I thank my distinguished colleague from Chicago.
I just have so many questions. I mean, some of my questions are just so quotidian, but the whole Michael Cohen thing, all the salaciousness aside, is so fascinating. And just, what was I listening to this morning? Oh, it was the ProPublica Trump Inc. podcast this morning was just talking about his past and how, in a fair way, they're basically saying it's funny how he's just surrounded by all these people who get disbarred and jailed. And he's just surrounded. He's got this taxi medallion industry and these kind of strange characters around him. I mean, can I jump straight to a question about, this is pretty specific, but about the Stormy Daniels NDA?
No, you can't. No, I'm just, yeah.
I can't?
Yeah, you can't. Knock yourself out.
There's just, I mean, first of all, like all the NDAs I've been exposed to mostly have been like, okay, if you're going to take a tour of Google, you have to sign this thing. Mm-hmm. Or if sometimes you work with a large company and they demand something, and my legal advice I've gotten was, that's fine as long as you get a basic mutual NDA. Just, along the lines of let's both be gentlemen about this. But I'm curious about what you think about what's been reported so far about the Stormy Daniels and related NDAs, which seem, this is a word I use maybe once a year. They are truly Kafkaesque, the way they're described, almost like a FISA warrant. Like, so I've heard it reported that you sign this NDA. This kind of a Luca Brasi situation, like, something's going to go on this paper, like you need to sign this NDA. And part of this NDA, some of these NDAs reportedly are that you cannot acknowledge, first of all, this never happened. We've done an existential annulment. Something that happened now hasn't happened. You have to agree that this didn't happen. You have to agree that you won't acknowledge that this NDA for the thing that didn't exist happened. And I've heard it reported, and you can tell me if this is true, that there are NDAs that exist in which someone agrees to even law enforcement and judges. They will say that this thing didn't happen. I just think the whole idea, and then of course, on top of it all, then you've got like, and if anything happens for any reason, it goes into private arbitration. So nobody finds out the thing that didn't happen, and you agree that it didn't happen. Is that kind of thing conventional? Am I getting the facts of this right? Have you heard these things reported? And how enforceable are these NDAs?
All right. That's like about 14 questions. So let me.
Basically what I'm saying is, I guess I could try and summarize it a little bit.
No, that's fine.
It sounds like what they've tried to do here is get people so scared from so many angles that I'm setting aside the sloppiness about how some of this was put together. But it's funny because it seems like Cohen kind of locked his own keys in his own car with some of these things, like not getting it signed and all this banana stuff. Where like now you're in a position where the president is saying, like, I don't need to go to court for this thing that didn't happen and the thing that I didn't sign. It all seems. Almost like vaudeville Kafka at this point. And I don't know. I just want to know your general feeling about what is the role of NDAs in this and what's likely to happen and how enforceable are these things?
All right. Let me start with the easiest question that you posed in there, which is this idea that you can contract away. I can make a contract with somebody that says you can't go to the law enforcement or the courts. That's totally not enforceable. Now, sometimes people can put language in contracts that's not enforceable. What I mean by not enforceable is it wouldn't hold up in court. Mm-hmm. So you can put language in a contract that wouldn't hold up in court. And the other side, it might scare the other side or give the other side the impression that they are bound by that. Now, typically, particularly here where the other side's advised by a lawyer, the lawyer is going to say, this isn't enforceable. So it doesn't really mean it's not worth the paper it's printed on. But occasionally that can be used to silence people. I'll give you an example of that is Sinclair had, Sinclair Broadcasting, the right wing, local broadcasting network has their reporters signed to these contracts that says that if you leave, you're going to have to pay us like 40% of 1 year's salary times some multiplier. That's not enforceable either, but it certainly did scare some Sinclair journalists. So that part of it is not enforceable. Now the rest of it. The fact that some people can enter into NDAs, there's a lot of question as to whether or not we should be limiting NDAs, whether or not NDAs should exist, particularly in the context of Me Too, and all the allegations there, whether, for example, women are coerced into signing NDAs. But the concept of an NDA in and of itself is pretty commonplace and not problematic. So I'll give you an example. I recently ran for office. I think every politician anybody who runs for office has their staff sign NDAs so that this way when they leave. Yeah, true.
Absolutely false. I've never signed an NDA in a political campaign.
Interesting. I think it's pretty...
I mean, I know Trump made his staff sign NDAs.
I think it's pretty common. And the idea being that you can't have somebody leave and go to to somebody else who's got a different political agenda and say, hey, here's everything I know about what's going on in the X campaign.
Oh, interesting. Maybe that's because I've had... consulting and not staff.
There's so much stuff, like you say, that relies on this kind of like keeping somebody so scared that it would never come up. But it also seems like, as with so many of these things, it feels like, I'm not an attorney, but it feels like in order for these to be enforceable, you'd have to be fairly specific about what's not allowed. Like you can't just say, don't talk about anything that happened here, because how enforceable would that be? And in the case of something like the Stormy Daniels case or these other cases, it seems like for them to stand up in whatever functions as a court, you would have to be fairly specific and lawyerly about describing what it is that you're not allowed to talk about, which by the very nature of the NDA does the thing the NDA is trying to cover up. It seems perplexing to me.
You know, whatever issues there are and there are a number of them with the NDA contract, the lack of specificity, I don't think, is the issue. I mean, there are lots of specifics about what she can't do in that agreement. So, for example, there's some sort of, I think they're called the protected material, the covered material, which are these various, whatever they are, text messages, photos, or whatever. She can't distribute them to anyone, and she has to retrieve them from all these people. There's lots of specific things she could or couldn't do, and you could imagine it. Let's just say all the P's and Q's were minded here.
What is that, if you had to guess?
The covered material, probably photos and text messages between her and Trump. Now, it could be, I'll just say this, because I mean...
Do you think she has a picture of the president's hog?
I don't know. I mean, one thing I will say is...
It could just be a selfie of them in a room, right?
It could just be
something that shows that they were together.
Correct.
On a date certain.
Correct. And one thing I'd also say, too, is, Cohen clearly did not... He did not take extreme care in drafting these. He was not a careful draftsman. So you could imagine that he's got the same form agreement that he uses for everybody. Like, in other words,
he's got a Word document. He keeps using the David Dennison with everybody. He just makes a clone.
Right. So my point is, to actually be fair,
that's like
Trump...
how I wrote college papers. You just right click, find synonym from Wikipedia.
Wow. So
Webster's defines existentialism.
I've been learning a lot about Max during this podcast. But anyway, plagiarism. So, but I will. The list of crimes goes on for Max. But in any event, what I would say though is just to be fair to him. Maybe there aren't any text messages or anything here, and he just kind of copied it from an old form. But I will say he did include the names of specific people that she had to retrieve the, quote, covered material, protected material, I forget now, from. And one of them was like a photographer, you know, who was involved in the adult film industry. So it seems like there's something there. I mean, there's certainly some specifics. I mean, you could imagine a deal where she's like, look, I'm going to sell my story to Magazine X. And he's like, well, you know what? I'll pay you $1 more than Magazine X to keep it. To sell it to me, and that could be a arm's length deal between two people. That it's like, okay, I don't really care. I just want money.
Now, the Stormy Daniels thing is not a federal issue. It's in New York State.
No,
right?
It got removed to federal court.
Oh, is that a new development?
No, that happened at one point, and her attorney. I mean, I've met Michael Avenatti in television studios. You know, he's a very crafty lawyer, also extremely great at getting publicity for himself and for his client.
Very handsome.
I feel like I've seen him on two channels at once.
I've been told he's very handsome. But in any event, he talked about that publicly because it actually helps them in certain ways because they get certain discovery under the Federal Arbitration Act. So in any event, there's a lot of issues with it. But the mere fact, like the mere concept of an NDA to me, is not like unusual. It's all of the bizarre things around it. And like you mentioned, the arbitration clause. I mean, one of the most important things that's going on here is, you know, Trump and Cohen are trying to force this in arbitration. Daniels doesn't want it in arbitration. And one major problem that I've talked a lot about on Twitter and on television is that Trump said publicly, and Cohen said publicly, and Cohen's attorney said publicly that Trump didn't know anything about this agreement. And the arbitration clause says, look, both Stormy Daniels and Donald Trump, using their pseudonyms, agree to have arbitration clauses with each other in exchange for the other person agreeing to have an arbitration clause and a number of other things. There's no way you can have a deal if the other person's like, I didn't know about it.
Well, there's one thing I learned from Judge Wapner. I learned that when you drop off your car, it doesn't create a bailment, whatever that means. And I learned that you can't have a contract without the meeting of the minds.
That is, there you go. Wow. There you go.
R.I.P. R.I.P. Judge Wapner.
So from Night Court.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
right. Bull was his name.
Big loss. Yeah. All right. So, okay. So I'm confused about the various levels of legal proceedings against Trump and the inner circle. So there's the sort
Do we have enough time to go through all of them?
Well, give us the 10,000 foot like can you explain the all the different jurisdictions and like what kind of things they're looking at? So you have Mueller on the federal issue, and now you have Stormy Daniels on the. By the way, can the president do a private arbitration? I mean, in his capacity as a public figure.
Well,
aren't we talking about a distinction here between the defamation suit from Avenatti and Stormy Daniels versus the SDNY stuff, which has been incidental to that. That's brought up there's really kind of two separate Stormy angles. Right?
Okay, yeah. So okay, hold on for a second. So there's the Mueller investigation, and we call it, and I'm putting quotes around air quotes. The Mueller investigation is really a group of related investigations, and what I mean by that is this: there's nothing logically that connects what Paul Manafort was doing to like these Russians on Facebook necessarily. Okay, he can be laundering money or whatever separately from what they're doing. It's just that Mueller happens to be the guy investigating all these different things, and we group them together and call them the Mueller investigation. So there's all these different court cases that Mueller's got. Papadopoulos, there's some guy in Florida who's selling fake bank accounts to the Russians, and all these various things that he's investigating.
Proud DePaul alumni, by the way. Do you know that?
Who? Papadopoulos? Yeah, you know, he's a Chicago native. Actually, I know his defense attorney, so another Chicago native.
That's a great gig. Busy guy.
Yeah, exactly right.
Not a coffee boy.
So anyway, so you got all those cases. Right? Then you've got, and then you have some ongoing investigations we don't even know that Mueller's got. Then you've got the Southern District of New York.
And that's all at the federal level.
All federal.
Right.
So what kicks up the Stormy Daniels case just because it involves people on the federal level? Like, how did that become, instead of a civil suit, a federal case?
The defendants in that case, which was the LLC that Cohen created, and Cohen and
Got
Trump
it.
Just moved it to federal court, I think based on the fact that you can have any, I don't recall because I haven't looked at it recently, but I think, you know, you can move any case to federal court if, for example, there's people in different states that are involved in
Got
the amount. It issues over $50,000. I just don't
know. I think I have this in my con law notes.
There
actually.
You go. Okay. or civil procedure or something. But I don't know. I just don't know offhand how
so
they removed
like
it.
So it's like super common.
It's not an uncommon
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, basically, defendants can pick. It's usually defendants just decide where they like the jurisdiction better, and then they get to pick the venue. And it's pretty.
That makes sense.
There's many factors. It's like not hard to remove it if you
got it
in
got
most
it.
Cases if that's what you want.
If you're, you know, the problem will be for you. The main ways that a federal court has jurisdiction is either if it involves federal law, the lawsuit mm-hmm. involves federal, or if there are people in different states that are parties, like plaintiff defendant parties, and the amount in controversy and the amount of money the lawsuit's about is over $50K. Well, if everybody's in the same, like if I sue Max, we're both in Illinois, and that could be a problem. Like it can destroy what's called destroying diversity. Then we're all both in the same state. But anyway, that's an aside. But getting back to so we have the Stormy Daniels lawsuit. That's just a civil lawsuit. There's mm-hmm. also another woman who filed a lawsuit, a similar type of situation. Then you also have in the Southern District of New York, a criminal investigation of Michael Cohen, which I will note that the federal prosecutor there described as a run-of-the-mill fraud case, essentially, against Cohen. I mean, he was not he made it sound like this is not some grand conspiracy involving Trump and all these other people. It's just Cohen was committing fraud on the side or something. So you have that going.
Everyone needs a hobby.
There you go. Yeah. That you have that going on. And then, so that's what that proceeding there. You have this, what we've saw this week was there's a civil proceeding that Cohen started to get a restraining order to stop the government in the underlying criminal case. And then, you know, we also, potentially have various, you know, potential state investigations, which we don't know exactly what is going on there in terms of state, you know, state investigations of the stuff that Mueller is working on.
Okay. Merlin, did you have some Michael Cohen questions? Because I know we were kind of getting into the taxi medallions and stuff last week. I don't know if you had anything on that. I really want to ask about the passport thing. I mean, that's the burning question that I
yeah.
have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got a feeling we might have gotten gaslit on that.
Gaslit?
Supposedly now there's still the one source reporting on that that has not been confirmed by many other places.
Yeah, could you explain the passport?
We call it the Prague stuff.
Could you explain the Prague stuff, the passport issue, and I don't know, what does that mean? That seems to have some implications for the dossier.
Talked about on the after show that was recently released to the public was that, I was just mentioning that it seemed interesting that when the, Carter Page calls it the dodgy dossier, when this dossier first came out, there were a lot of things that seemed plausible, some things that could be proven, but there were two giant things in there that seemed one very salacious and the other super interesting. One of those being that supposedly... What's happening?
I think Max is doing a bit, and it's a very good bit, and I like it.
Oh,
proceed.
He's doing the bit.
Proceed.
Oh, jeez, man. We got an attorney here, Max.
Oh, I want it so bad. I just...
Keep it in the glass. Anyway, let's set that one aside. But the other one was... that supposedly Michael Cohen, in his role as the fixer, had gone to Prague to meet with Russians or Russian cutouts in order to smooth over what had been happening with Manafort. And that was one thing that immediately Cohen popped out of the wallpaper to say, I've never been to Prague. Here's a photo of my passport, apparently proving something legally.
But the cover of the passport.
The front of his passport, yeah. Yeah. That just seemed real interesting because, you know, I mean, obviously, I'm not trying to make the same joke Max did. I'm just curious because it does say, though, it would seem to say that, you know, these two pieces, one of these remaining pieces in the dossier might have some basis. Do you have any thoughts on what we know about that and what that would mean?
There's a lot. Yeah, a lot there. So the biggest implication that is not really a legal implication, although there is a legal implication as well. But the bigger implication is this. The Republicans and Trump supporters have made a lot of very unfair and over-the-top allegations regarding Mueller and his investigation. And perhaps the biggest allegation that they've made is the whole thing is resting on like a foundation of quicksand, because it was based entirely upon this, what they call, quote, unverified dossier, unquote.
Funded by Crooked Hillary.
There you go. Funded by, and the reality of that dossier, the 30-second or 20-second version is, there was a dossier that was created by a man who is a former British intelligence officer who was hired by a firm that was paid for by Republican opposition to Trump, opponents to Trump, anti-Trump Republicans. Then after Trump won the primary,
like the Jeb Bush pack, right?
I don't know exactly, but yeah. some opponent to Trump, and then it was picked up by Democrats later. There was a law firm that represents the DNC or Democrats who was paying for this work to continue. That British intelligence officer, who has been a source for the FBI and has worked with U.S. intelligence for a number of years, put out this dossier. It's got many claims, not just salacious, but actually very important and troubling claims in it. And some of those claims have been verified, but some of the most explosive claims have not. The centerpiece of it was, you know, one of the things that the right was using to claim, and Trump and his allies were using to claim, that the dossier could not be trusted, was this claim that Cohen was in Prague. Because it's very much a yes or no thing. Either he knows it's in Prague, or either he was in Prague or not. And he, you know, not only did he put that photo of the passport on Twitter, but apparently he showed it to journalists and said, hey, there's no stamp in here. There was, a number of journalists pointed out, you don't need a stamp.
From an evidentiary point of view, though, that's like nothing, right? Because like I travel all the time and I don't get a stamp.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something.
Manafort had three passports.
It's something, but yeah, it doesn't necessarily. It's not dispositive, but it's something. I mean, it would be evidence you could point to. So there was certainly a big claim there, and he came out very hard on that point. And one thing I would say on their side of it is, typically when somebody comes that forcefully on a point, that means that they feel have a level of confidence on it. Because obviously, if you believe there might be evidence out there to the contrary, you're going to look really stupid. Now, we have seen Michael Cohen is not afraid to say things that ultimately later on turn out to be not true, or there is evidence to the contrary. But I'm just saying that people caused some pause from journalists because I think journalists are concerned about, you know, being accurate, rightfully so, that was like, okay, well, this guy seems pretty damn sure he wasn't in Prague. He's got at least some evidence to back it up. We need to be cautious about that. So this report suggested what it said, and I want to be very careful about it. What it said was that Mueller has evidence that Cohen was in Prague. Now, what that could be, for example, is it could be, you know, phone records showing, well, that, you know, his phone was hitting off cell towers in Prague, for example. Doesn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was there, but it's very strong
unless
evidence.
Unless you're a kid from
cereal. Well, it's strong evidence. Well, it's very strong. I use that evidence all the time when I was a federal prosecutor. It's very strong evidence. So, you know, it could be something like that. We don't know. But it hasn't been reported by anyone else. And a number of journalists have been exercising caution on it. And I will say one thing that I find very interesting, as I've gotten to know a lot of journalists over the last year and a half or so, is there's very much like a sort of secret underground thing, you know, knowledge that journalists have about things that they don't print. Everyone, you know, like, for instance, that guy in, was it the New Yorker that, or who is it that published that piece that you were talking about earlier, you thought
the
was
Adam
very interesting?
Davidson one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think New Yorker.
New Yorker. Yeah. You know, he's really the only there that is underlying what he's saying is, like, we're kind of, you know, there's a lot of stuff here and there's not a lot of stuff there. And he doesn't really say what
it
is.
That's the strongest point he made in that whole piece to me, which is he said, you know, in 2003, President Bush landed on that aircraft carrier and said, mission accomplished. And support for the war was at 70% at home. But he was on the ground in Iraq, and he was looking at the disaster of the operation there. And he was like, these guys can say what they want at home, but the truth will come out. And to your point, like, it was hard at the time for journalists to say Bush is a liar because the case wasn't there. But in enough time, the case was made and the people turned on it. He made the same point for the financial collapse. Like in 2007, mm-hmm. most financial journalists like knew that there was this house of cards and that the banks were overleveraged and that there was this looming crisis. And again, it was like you said, it's this underlying knowledge that people paying attention have. But it's hard to like breaking news in the New York Times. Like it's not.
They don't have enough there yet.
Yeah, but eventually the truth, you know, came out. And I think was his point with Trump of like, there is this, like the people paying attention, like there is this preponderance of evidence accumulating, but it's not, it's like it's going to take time for the public to learn it and catch up.
It's more than that. I mean, what I would say is there is not, I mean, I follow this stuff very closely. There is not evidence to support, for example, what he's necessarily saying that's in the public knowledge for what he's saying in that column or whatever it was, your opinion piece or whatever it was. But journalists seem to have, you know, kind of know certain things or not know certain things. And they're not all bad for Trump. Some of them are helpful to Trump. Like there's journalists who've told me off the record that, you know, Trump was told by his people that firing Comey was going to lengthen the Mueller investigation. It was going to lengthen the Russia investigation. It was going to be a problem for him. You know, that's good for Trump because it shows that he wasn't, you know, potentially wasn't firing Comey with that corrupt intent because he didn't care. You know,
he could have had, if he was smart enough to have corrupt intent, he could have had it. But the problem is he's too incompetent to take the advice of his cronies and pull off a conspiracy.
So it truly was he was just mad on Twitter, right?
That's great Trump defense. It's like, actually, Your Honor, I'm too incompetent to execute a conspiracy.
You know, it's funny because we all can laugh.
Is there an amendment for that?
We can all laugh about it. But, you know, one of the most common ways that you defend white-collar cases, that defense counsel defend them, is they say, look, my guy is just – he's either too busy to be paying attention or he wasn't on top of things. Or I mean, they don't come out and say my guy was stupid or foolish or incompetent, but there's this element like this guy was just not the criminal mastermind that the government believes. He's just like a guy who's reactionary or mean or this or that, but he's not that guy. And that's you know, if there were a trial, I think that would very much be the type of defense you'd bring for Trump. So anyways, my point is just that I find it interesting because I see it from when I talk to journalists, like, well, you know, I'm hearing this, but, you know, so they definitely have a kind of a level of knowledge that's underneath the surface, which I didn't realize. As honestly, as a person who read newspapers, I figured when they had knowledge about things, I was generally reading it in print. But that's not the case.
Well, I think like most serious publications have they wait for like triple confirmation. I don't know. Maybe it's the standards are looser now, but like you want it from like three independents. Well, like if you've seen All the President's Men, right? Like they can't go on a lot of the Watergate stuff because they don't have their third source. That's like a big plot point in the movie.
And yeah.
I wonder if the standards have slipped since then, but you know, you do hope that they're at least have, you know, they can source it from a couple of different directions.
Well, certainly amongst there's certainly that a case amongst a lot of serious journalists. I had, for example, a New York Times reporter talk to me and say, you know, when I was commenting on reports from other very respected publications, that like if you read this story, you'll see that it's not well sourced enough. You need to be a more educated media consumer. And I'm like, well, it's the X newspaper that's very widely respected. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, yeah, but read the piece. And it's like, you know, you really have to be a pretty sophisticated media consumer to really look at these things and see how well sourced. So a lot of people, when they saw that McClatchy thing about Cohen, like, well, what kind of sourcing did they have? And they were really asking a lot of details. And, you know, it seems like there's some caution around it.
All right. So I have two questions for you on that topic. Number one, so these are questions I have as just a consumer of news. Like this, I'm just a guy trying to just follow this story enough to get what I need to get. So my first question is, how do you read the news? Personally, just like, what is your news consumption like? And then also, like, do you have any advice for me or for our audience on, like, I don't know, how do I say, do you have like any heuristics of like, this is how you like think about a story critically to you know, to understand whether you should get excited about it or not?
Wow. Those are big questions. I mean, the first one, I'll tell you what I do because that's an easy one. I subscribe to multiple newspapers. I subscribe to the Chicago Sun-Times and the New York Times and the Washington Post and so on. But I don't like pull up the app and read the paper every day. Mm-hmm. What I do is I have certain You know, stories that are emailed to me. Like, for instance, I read Natasha Karecki's Illinois Politics
great coverage
email every day. I read other – I'm on various other email lists that cull sort of the articles.
Give us some specific – I mean, I think this is the exact kind of nerdy stuff that our audience is going to be crazy about. Yeah.
Well,
underlying question Max is asking, hopefully, like, for me, is how do we not go crazy? And, like, we're so anxious – and like, what is something useful to consume?
You know, I will tell you, I don't have a magic answer for that, because I often feel like the news cycle has gotten so crazy. As somebody who's trying to comment on the news, it's very difficult for me to keep up, and it is affected my life in many ways, because trying to keep up with that is really an extra job, and I have multiple jobs at this point, and it is very, very challenging to keep up with all of it. And if I wasn't this motivated to do it, just because I know I will be asked questions, like here, I'm being asked questions right now, and I still don't know every detail of every contract, I don't know how I could do it. The news cycle is moving so quickly right now. What I do is, so like some of the things I was talking about, you know, I mentioned Natasha's, email, but there's also, you know, groups I'm on. Like, for instance, there's a whole group of, you know, just a private listserv of people who are concerned about issues relating to the Russian investigation, and I get emails from them. I get emails from.
Do you guys do like a Google group?
Yeah, we have like a Google group. Exactly. Okay. We have like I'm a member of the American Constitution Society, and they'll send me, things that I should be looking at or care about.
What a fun, relevant time for them.
It is a very very relevant time for I do a lot with that organization, and they're very, I think, underappreciated. But I do that stuff. I read Twitter a lot, as you gather. And
that's a fun feeling, lying in bed at 10:45 at night, just refreshing Twitter over and over, just watching a story break. You know, just a pit of anxiety in your stomach. You're like, well, no way I'm going to sleep now.
Well, I will tell you, one thing that's amazing is several times a day there are stories that are breaking that are important and interesting enough to comment on, and it just depends on whether I have time to look at my phone. I mean, I'm here on this podcast for all we know, whatever. There's been major indictments brought by Robert Mueller, and we're not even talking about them because we're here.
I'm monitoring that in real time.
Isn't that a fun part of going? This is an aside, but do you guys find that that's like part of the fun, like movie going experience now? Of like, so you go see your Marvel movie, you stay for the after shot where they have the shawarma at the end of the credits, and then you take your phone out and you're like, I wonder if Trump is still
altering Ready Player One, my phone was going off, and I'm like, what's going on?
Well, I tell you, I do feel like this almost a sense of responsibility, because there's a lot of people that follow me on Twitter who are like, if I don't comment on something for a few hours, they're like, I get all these tweets, they're like, what do you think of this or that, or what's happening, and oh my god, you haven't said anything, and what does this mean? And it's like, my god, people, you know, I was watching a movie, or you know, I was at dinner,
getting a filling, leave me alone.
And I'm like, I really care. I mean, look, I care about, I appreciate these people, and I want to be able to help them, because that's what I do. Is a lot of what you're saying, you know, how can we do it? A lot of it is on my Twitter feed. I literally try to digest everything.
That's been, just not to shine your butt too hard here, but like, that's one thing I really value that you do on Twitter, is when something happens, you very quickly hop in and we'll do a thread. I'm not generally such a huge fan of threads, but I think you do a real nice job of summarizing the what this means right now part of it. But part of it
I'll just add also, like, I don't think, you know, Renato did not like invent this genre, because there were these kind of lunatics on Twitter who were doing these threads, and they were like, who's that with Sarah Kendzior, and there's that other dude, and they're like, the Marshal of the Supreme Court has sealed indictments, and there's going to be a coup, they're going to, at midnight, they're going to converge on the White House, and, you know, they're going to serve the president, and it's like...
When you're reading Twitter, is this the voice that's happening?
These people are little gremlins, they're all little wizards waving their staffs around, they're just furiously banging out. Patriotics, and it's like they're all like cold readers. They're like mind readers, right? It's like if you have every possible prediction in a sealed envelope, then whatever happens, you're like, I predicted it. Like,
one thing I will say that is very hard that I try to do is I try to be this like cold voice of reality yes. for everybody.
Sober.
And yeah, and I think it's really hard. Very quickly, I started doing this in May or June of last year. And so it hasn't even been a year yet. And a month or two in, a lot of my followers at the time, I don't know, it was only a couple thousand of them by that point, were like, they're like, oh, this is a bummer. Because all these people are telling us like everyone's going down and being let out in chains. And you're like, well, I don't know. I'm not so sure about whether the criminal justice system is going to achieve all this stuff. And I did this whole thread for them about like the limits of the criminal justice system and how they need to get off their butts and like vote and organize and do stuff because they should not sit back and wait for Bob Mueller to save America for them because it's not going to happen. Like he's not like some right. magic man who's going to come from the clouds and wave a wand. That's just not how the criminal justice system works.
It's not Wakanda. Like he can't challenge the president to single combat and then the physically strongest male becomes the new president.
You're ruining the movie for me, man.
Oh, sorry. Spoilers. let's see. What did I had a
you? Well, I have a question. Yeah. Let me know if ahead, ahead of this. You answered basically most of the questions I had. Thank you so much. But what does the Sean Hannity stuff mean? Like, I personally hate the man. And I want to get excited about it, but I don't really know why I should be excited and why it's bad that does that make sense? Like,
yeah, what, I mean, it's really
what happened.
It's very it really pains me to say anything favorable towards Sean Hannity because I don't have very favorable feelings towards the man myself, given that I think he's, often lying to people on television. But there's a lot less to the story than I think. I mean, it was very shocking when it happened, and really, I think Michael Cohen and his counsel, if they really wanted to keep this a secret, did a very bad job of it. Like they literally are like, here's a court filing where we lay out who his clients are and there's one secret one and we're going to explain in detail about this guy but not mention his name and like build up this anticipation knowing that at some point this was going to come out. It was just building this. Mm-hmm. What I think really may have happened there, I don't know. But one thing that that gives me a little caution about this is Cohen had an incentive to make himself seem like, and I'm going to put this in air quotes here, a real lawyer. In other words, I mean, yes, Michael Cohen is a lawyer. He's got a law license, but like he doesn't appear to have been practicing law much. The government said as much. They literally said this guy does zero to one clients as far as we know. the government was like, this guy is not really practicing law. And he's like, no, I am practicing law. And he's like searching while
he turns his pockets inside out and three clients fall out.
Well, essentially it was like he's trying to squint and say who are his
Got
clients.
It.
And here's the thing, if you ask me who are my clients, I mean, I wouldn't tell you, but there are a limited number of people who have like engagement letters at my law firm who I actually represent in lawsuits. You can search my name in federal court and see, okay, he's listed as the counsel in these suits. But then there's like a variety of people who ask me about legal topics. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, well, I don't really think you've got a case or you should really consider X or Y. And then I never hear from them again because I didn't tell them what they wanted to hear or they don't have the money to bring a suit or they just don't feel like it at that time. And I don't go chasing down all these people because if they really want to bring a suit or do something, they'll come back to me.
Are you subtweeting me right now?
Max, I'm not revealing anything about anything.
Right. Attorney-client privilege.
Exactly. No, actually,
let me slide you a dollar.
No, but this is actually an important point because those conversations are privileged because if you go to somebody seeking legal advice, even if you don't hire that person, you still have attorney-client privilege. Could you imagine if you didn't? Mm. You go to a lawyer and you're like, I'd like to consider hiring your firm for my lawsuit. You end up not going with that person because you don't think they're a good lawyer. And they tell the world everything that you told them.
Or they go to the opposition, right?
Right.
They have info.
Yeah, or whatever. So you can't know. So you do have attorney-client privilege. People do approach me. And I technically have some relationship with them? Yeah, sort of technically. But they're not formally – we haven't formally developed an attorney-client relationship. But there is privilege there. So technically speaking, could Cohen have had one or two conversations with Hannity and had some, technically speaking, an attorney-client privilege conversation with them? Yes. Did he have any reason to believe that it was in those boxes of documents seized by the government? I don't know. And there's a number of different ways it could go. Either maybe there's more to this than Hannity's letting on and there's some box of documents that has 50, pieces of correspondence between him and Cohen. Perhaps. On the other hand, it's also possible that like Hannity and Cohen had two conversations, never were written down, or two brief emails about a nothing thing, and Cohen's blowing it up into more than it is. Who knows? Because neither of these people have a really great relationship with the truth, either Hannity or Cohen. So who knows which one is telling the truth? But certainly there's all sorts of possibilities in there.
Another question I had that it feels like you have answered was just, is Cohen super bad at his job? But a few it wasn't until a few days ago that I realized, oh, he's not doing lawyer things. He's a fixer. He's a big taxi man. And so is he doing a good job as a fixer, or is he fuck that up too?
Well, he hasn't done, there's a number of very obvious mistakes that Michael Cohen has made, okay? Mm-hmm. And one of them I already pointed out is, you know, what he was doing with that NDA does appear to be legal work, or at least resembles it, which is, here's a contract, he's presenting it to another party and saying, please, you know, who has a lawyer, and saying, hey, sign this deal with mm-hmm. my client. But the way he structured the deal was all screwed up. If he really wanted to keep Trump out of it, he wouldn't have had Trump in the agreement under a pseudonym, making all these promises, releasing claims, forming, it would have been strictly between the LLC and Daniels, and Trump wouldn't have been a part of it. Instead, he includes Trump and has Trump make a bunch of promises but not sign it. And even that might have been okay if Trump knew about it but just didn't affix his signature, but was part of the deal or was understood in some other sense, or at least you could make some argument there. But then he comes out and says, through his spokesman at first, but then I believe he confirms himself, that Trump knew nothing about the agreement. So that is all really bad lawyering if he wants the agreement to hold up. Another thing that he's made a big mistake about is, we know he's somebody under criminal investigation, mm-hmm. and that should have been apparent to him a long time ago when he's being interviewed by Bob Mueller and so on, and yet he's on the record to the press talking about Donald Trump as if he's like a guy who's going to take a fall for Trump or has some deep-seated loyalty for the guy. It just didn't move anything forward for him at all, other than potentially sending a signal to Trump that I am going to be loyal to you. But you think he could mm-hmm. have done that privately from his attorney to Trump's attorney without telling the New Yorker that.
So what's Mueller's role in this? Mueller is, he turned the Cohen case over to a state prosecutor in New York.
Well, my understanding is, and I, if I'm wrong about this, I apologize, but I'm pretty sure that Mueller interviewed Cohen. I'm almost positive that it happened, or there was press reports that had happened. So Cohen was originally a witness. Then in the course of his investigation, reportedly, I think this was according to Bloomberg, Mueller found these apparently unrelated crimes in New York by Cohen, went to Rosenstein, and Rosenstein is the deputy attorney general who oversees the Mueller investigation, said these are more appropriately handled by federal prosecutors
that
in New York.
That may not be true on Friday when this comes out, by the way, but as of recording.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's who Rod Rosenstein was.
Okay, yeah. There you go.
As of Wednesday the 18th.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I always wonder, like, will the president be impeached by the time the show comes out?
I think we need to give Renato an escape hatch here if you need to take off. But mm-hmm. You have gone above and beyond here. But mm-hmm. I'll pose this to you this is at least my last question. Could you tell us a little bit about, there's been two sort of, I'll call them political big news pardons of the Trump presidency. There's Sheriff Arpaio and there's Scooter Libby. Can you talk a little bit about what happened with those pardons? And do you think is that a signal? Is it a test balloon? Like, what do you take from that?
Well, they're really unusual pardons. So the president has very broad powers to pardon under the Constitution, but typically mm-hmm. there's a process that there's – you can literally Google it and you can go to the office of the pardon attorney. There's a person called the pardon attorney that's part of the Justice Department. It has a whole office of people who collect petitions for pardons, and they have various requirements of what you should put in your petition, and they examine these petitions. They send them back to – they actually send them to the prosecutorial office that originally prosecuted you. I handled some of those when I was a federal prosecutor on behalf of my office, cases that had been prosecuted by my former office.
Meaning your office put someone in jail.
Right.
And then the governor or the I guess the president in the course of investigating a pardon consulted with you as the prosecutor to say, what do you think of this move?
Right. So what happens is people who are prosecuted by my former office here in Chicago made a petition for pardon or clemency. as part of that process, they said, we want the United States Attorney's Office in Chicago to weigh in because you were the office that prosecuted. These were all cases that were before my time because they were, you know, people who were sitting in prison from, you know, years earlier. This is the sort of thing a baby prosecutor does. And I would go and I'd look and I'd write, you know, look at the evidence and look at the various factors and write a memo saying, here is what we, our position is one way or the other as to
this.
You
say, no, this black kid had 1 gram of marijuana, so he should spend his life in prison. No clemency.
No comment. In any event.
Clemency denied.
Officer,
put a stamp sound effect
in
there.
You know, I will tell you, actually, one thing I'm gonna use this as a chance to say something that people aren't very aware of, but they should be, there was President Obama had a program in which he invited people who were convicted of nonviolent drug offenses to seek clemency. Yep. And he got thousands of petitions.
A historic number.
Yes. Yeah. Thousands of petitions for clemency. And offices, U.S. attorneys' offices, were overwhelmed. And before I left, there was a high-ranking person in the office who spent the majority of her time looking at all of those, trying to get as many done as she possibly could during her time there. And I will say, wow. I went, you know, the American Constitution Society organized an event in D.C. that I went to and spoke to senators and their staff about clemency. And I think they wanted me to talk about Trump pardoning Arpaio and other things like that. But I talked about that program and how I think we should do the same thing at the state level. I think that's something that could be a really important way that we can reform the criminal justice system. So that plug for that. Now, moving to the Arpaio and Libby pardons, those pardons did not go through that process, which is really interesting mm-hmm. and different. They went, you know, in the Arpaio pardon, it didn't seem to go through any process. You know, there were some press reports that Libby's attorneys were somehow reaching out to the White House.
But some old vampire from the Bush administration had a meeting with Trump, right? Who was – someone was in the White House. Right? You guys know who I'm talking about?
Well, my understanding was that Libby's lawyer was seeking to be the lawyer for Trump, right? Is that what you're thinking of, that person?
Was it Dick Cheney or – Merlin, do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Someone from the Bush administration met with Trump.
Can you just look in your crystal ball, man?
Yeah, hang on. Let me pull it up.
Right that here. Was for Merlin, not for you. But
you got it.
Right. But anyways, okay, it's a little too lame of a joke for this crew.
It's a camera remote.
Okay, but in any event, the point that I'm making is
this is what we call a gateway joke. But now on this podcast, we're into the harder stuff. So we're we're freebasing. We're freebasing humor over here.
Wow. But in any event, it's unusual. Those pardons were unusual for that reason, and it suggests that there was some more political motivation there because they didn't go through the typical process. They weren't, you know, for example, one component of the pardon process is that the person who's being
– Oh, the Dersh.
Oh, Dershowitz, you mean?
Trump met with the Dersh like the day before the Scooter Libby pardon went down.
Okay. You know, I don't know which way that cuts for Dershowitz or for Libby, but the point I was going to make is you usually have to seek, for example, you have to express remorse as part of one of the factors. You know, certainly Joe Arpaio did not express any remorse and was defiant and said that he had been railroaded. Trump was essentially sending a signal there. I mean, I think at least that was my argument, and I wrote a piece about it at the time and talked about it. That he was sending a signal that what Arpaio did, by the way, was he countervetoed a judicial order, and essentially he was sending a signal that you can do that and that's okay, and I'm going to side with the guy doing what advances my agenda, which was, you know, Arpaio's agenda was very anti-immigrant, even if it means that you're violating judicial orders. It was quite a signal, I think, to be sending potentially to people who are in the Mueller investigation. And the Libby, I think the Libby pardon was much more of a signal because what he was saying that same day when he issued that pardon, you know, Kellyanne Conway was saying that he was essentially mistreated by the former special counsel, the previous special counsel, my former boss, Pat Fitzgerald, who has a very sterling reputation, I would say, not only here in Illinois but elsewhere, and was, somebody you can imagine being a stand-in for Mueller. And what he's essentially saying, I took it to be a message to the Republican base saying special counsels are bad. Don't you remember you guys all hated Fitzgerald and what he did to Libby? We should make the case that all special counsels are bad. And you've seen this recently. I've seen it recently. National Review ran a piece this past week saying all special counsels are bad. We need to curtail all special counsels. Come on, Democrats. Don't you remember you hated Kenneth Starr when when he was an independent counsel. And really, what it's a masquerade for, let's let Trump off, but for high-minded reasons. And to me personally, what Trump has done is underscored why we need special counsels, and really we need them to be the independent counsel that Starr was, because you cannot have a situation where a president can undermine the person investigating him.
That's the difference between an independent counsel, an independent prosecutor, and a special prosecutor.
The independent counsel is essentially created by statute and is often has their own independent authority and can't easily be removed. The special counsel also supposedly can't be easily removed. They can only be removed for cause, but they have the attorney general can remove them for good cause. But you know, of course, Trump could fire attorney generals until he gets the one that was willing to do it, or he could just get rid of the regulations, and that's another thing. Get rid of the regulations, Sessions get rid of the regulations, and then just fire Mueller himself. And it's something I think we all have to be concerned about.
What happens? I mean, I've heard people talk about this on Twitter a lot, but like, what actually happens if there's a constitutional crisis in this country? I mean, my guess is nothing. But do you have any?
Well, I mean, you know, it's uncharted. It's really can be uncharted territory. In the past, what's happened when we've had constitutional crises is there's enough institutions and high-minded people around that are like, hey. We need to do something about this. Like when Richard Nixon was essentially trying to defy had his own purge of an independent counsel. It was like, hey, you know, we can't stand for this. Now, obviously, one thing I'll note is the Congress there was controlled by Democrats at the time, so it's the opposition party. But there was very much the sense that, you know, we can't let Nixon, you know, go against what this country's all about. You know, what's scary now is that number of people seems to be very small, and it tends to be Republicans who are not seeking re-election and a very small number of Republicans who feel like there's something bigger at stake, like Lindsey Graham. There was another gentleman who just co-sponsored a Mueller Mueller protection bill, and to his credit. And then the leadership, you know, you saw Mitch McConnell yesterday. I know that for podcast listeners, that'll be days ago now. But you know, just yesterday, Mitch McConnell said, I'm not going to let that to the floor. I'm not going to let this bill protecting Mueller to the floor. There's very much a consensus, I think, within the Republican Party that they don't really care about these broader concerns as long as Trump stays in office.
I think that's when you've seen a couple of things of like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have said to Trump, and this has been in the press, don't fire Mueller, it's going to make everything worse. And or other Republican leadership have said that to him. And I think actually people have celebrated that and said, oh, finally, the high-minded civic spirit has returned to America. But I think actually what's implicit in that is saying, if you fire Mueller, it's going to add fuel to this fire. Whereas if you just let this thing burn out, we're not going to do anything about it, and it will go nowhere. That's what's really dark and scary about that, is they're saying to Trump, just let this thing run its course. And ultimately, you know, like you said, like worst case scenario, it gets referred to the House for impeachment, and that's a non-starter.
Yeah, I will tell you, this whole concern about a constitutional crisis is one of the things that really had an impact on me in my life. Typically people who are former federal prosecutors don't like tweet out and go on television and stuff like that. And I started doing some of that after Comey got fired, and I still kept it like pretty much very just, you know, hey, here, I'm informative, I'm not really taking political positions. But then Charlottesville happened, and mm-hmm. there started to be this crisis about Mueller, and I just felt like I couldn't be silent and just be somebody who's just explaining things. And I started, you know, expressing my views more, for better or for worse. I'm not that blank slate that a lot of times I think lawyers want to present themselves to be. But honestly, I think like to me, as somebody who is a lawyer and has been around the criminal justice system, I mean, you know, you can have whatever criticisms you want about the criminal justice system. I think we all can agree that we need a criminal justice system and that people shouldn't be able to just fire everyone that's investigating them. It's a very dangerous thing for this country. I'm really concerned about it, and I have been organizing with those people who are organizing those protests across the country. I've been working with them for a long time, because I think if I don't have the ability or to do anything personally about this, but I think we mm-hmm. need to put as much pressure as we can on our elected officials if this sort of constitutional crisis happens.
Well, I think you do have the ability. I mean, you can and you have run for public office, which I thought was an incredible public service, and you brought brought up all of these great federal issues and made the attorney general's race really exciting in Illinois. And I was very happy to vote for you.
Well, thanks a lot. I mean, it's, you know, I will tell you this past week when Rosenstein looked like he was going to be fired, you know, I was talking to some of these folks who are organizing this and like, what can we do? And I'm like, well, we're going to go out, we're going to peacefully protest and do whatever we can. And I tried with that run to do what I could to, you know, bring these issues out there, but there's only so much. I'm not the attorney general. I'm not the in Congress or anything where I, but even there, I mean, you know, the reality is the Democrats in Congress essentially are, you know, they're just protesting themselves. They can do filibusters or do other things, but ultimately every organ of our federal government right now is controlled by the Republicans. And until there's a change there, nothing is going to be done about this.
Well, if you do want to get into the more traditional work of a prosecutor post prosecutorial career, I'm thinking of licensing my name to some hotel developments in North Korea. So if you want to represent me on that deal, you know, it's going to be very very lucrative, I think, for both of us.
Wow. I'll tell you, I've drummed up a lot of business. My law firm is going to be very pleased. I've drummed up a lot of business over the course of this podcast.
No. That we could help.
Anyone else? So I think we should probably get to our challenge. You're welcome to stick around if you want to talk about...
we should let this man go.
Yeah.
What is the challenge? I'm just curious.
Challenge this fuck, God, Jesus Christ.
Hold up, Merlin, do you have any more questions?
No. We've kept him alive.
Thank you so much
for being here.
Yeah.
This was really nice. Thanks for your time. Thanks for joining us.
And thanks for what you do. I mean, I think it's really helpful. And amidst mm-hmm. all the noise and stuff, you've been real helpful to me in getting some clarity on stuff that feels very chaotic. So I just want to say thanks for that. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks. The challenge this week was to mix a bunch of sodas together from a soda machine and make a suicide. So just in case you were, Renato looks very concerned right now. Just in case there was any ambiguity about the kind of podcast that you were on.
Wow. If I knew this in advance, I would not be here.
Yeah, I soft played that. Yeah, I soft pedaled that in my email. Yeah.
We're a pop culture podcast. It's like,
we are talking about pop culture today.
Yeah, we also know words like exculpatory, so we're real brainy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you're the one who brought off Kafka. I mean, you're more brainy than I am, man. So, anyway. All right. Well, I will head out and let you guys mix sodas to your delight.
Thank you so much
for coming.
Thank
you again.
Thanks for your time. I owe you a drink.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Just as long as it's not a suicide.
Oh. Jazz break. Oh, I have an entire collection of drill tweets.
Boy, you're doing I don't know. I mean, you know, this was like a big meme of like you tweet like a Trump thing and a drill thing side by side. And I mean,
it works for so many things.
It's a drill is a brilliant. It makes me so happy that you get your toes in the water here.
I spent probably 15 minutes this morning trying to find, because Kanye's having a hell of a day. And I was trying to find the right one for his thing about how everything he's doing is for his book that no one will publish. And it just felt so drill. It was so perfect. I love the ones about my followers. You know, the ones, trolls. Unlike you, I have a brain. It's called a job. Hang on. Hear this, trolls. This is your favorite, Max. Hear this, trolls. I've been secretly respecting the flag and the privacy of my garage for 12 hours a day, maxing out its power to insane levels.
There is something about that drill voice that is like just perfectly suited for this moment. Like it was a little ahead of its time and now it's really come into its own.
I would love to lift all of my pathetic, frail followers by the ankles and huck them like tomahawks.
Good God.
I have proof that the women on here are forming quote tweet gangs to freak out and intimidate uncircumcised guys. I despise the toilet. I'd love nothing more than to kick it through the wall and shatter it into 100 shards of wet porcelain, but I need it.
I mean, for logistics reasons, why don't we just address quickly what the challenge was? We knew that we'd have
a
special...
Can I just do one more?
Oh, yes, please. Yes, please.
Getting pissed off, imagining my trolls and dissenters crawling around my house in little butler outfits and expecting tips.
I love it. But it's so
It ends up being so perfect for people like Jordan Peterson,
yes,
or Eric Garland. It's like so. It's like Eric Garland constantly. I mean, do you? I don't follow him. I don't even. But occasionally he'll pop up with this. Like, you have no idea what it's like. All the women I'm protecting and I'm being threatened all the time.
A lot of the people that I follow on Twitter imagine themselves to be like Eric Garland's like interlocutor. Like they're gonna like, you know, they're gonna like nail him like when he tweets. So I see a lot of like quote retweets where like someone says something stupid and they're like, now hear me, sir, like you have finally, you know, crossed the line, or like they're making fun of him or whatever.
He released the Kraken.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just the whole thing is Twitter fucking sucks.
This is a great one though. The website lioncomey.com is registered out of Panama. No, it's an anonymous domain registration front in Panama, Pennsylvania. To which I responded, just put my elbow through the monitor because I thought the cursor was a bug again. Nevertheless, this setback will not slow down my posting. Okay.
I've learned nothing from my error.
The entire time this discussion was going on, Max was wielding a box cutter, and I'm like, what
happens
if it's
just a... Oh, I just have treats. Listen, I'm going to open all these I have a big old pile of packages. I don't know what they are. I have some theories as to what they are.
This is it. This is the day we're going to break the record. I'm not going to get my pho before 1 o'clock, am I?
Okay. And I'm going to open these packages on the after show for our new listeners of Due by Friday. We actually record a whole second episode every week, and you can get it if you give us your money, because that's the thing, is you have money and we want your money. So you can go to giveusyourfuckingmoney.com. You give us $5 a month and you get access to a whole second episode of Due by Friday every week. On this week's bonus episode, I have this huge pile of boxes. It's taller than I am. I'm going to open all this stuff up and we're going to find out what secrets lie within. Could be anything.
I'm just finding lots of pictures of
Merlin,
data
order
from
your
trial.
Pho. From all of our iTunes reviews, I can tell that people really enjoy when we eat on the show.
First of all, never look at the reviews. And second of all, no, I have to do the pho at home because I have a special method and I can't do it here at the office.
I want some pho. That sounds delicious.
I'm going to include your method in the show notes because that was
fascinating. I order two different pho's.
I wonder if my UPS package got delivered yet. Please, God.
All right, the challenge this week was to make what...
Challenge.
I don't know how to say it.
What about pan and panel? You say pan and panel?
Pan.
Say
pan,
car.
Car.
Care.
I don't, I'm not like car. I'm not from...
Max, I got sport peppers coming.
Oh, shit, dog.
Yeah.
Now, you know, let me bring up something that I learned on Twitter this week. So I wrote a little list of my, I have this like little database, like, don't make fun of me. No one could loathe me more than myself, but I have a little spreadsheet of my favorite restaurants in Chicago, and I put it on my website so I could share this information with the people.
And then you said to people, send me comments about this.
Yeah. You can find my website. It's expectations.management. I'm getting some wonderful, what's cool is I'm like, people are sending me their favorite restaurants in Chicago that I've never even heard of. And I'm learning about all these great street food places, and they're going on the list. But anyhow, something occurred to me when I started sharing this list with an audience of people outside of Chicago. At a number of places, I recommended that people get a sandwich and they put something on it called jardinera, or sometimes people will say jardinere. And it occurred to me that most people in the country, so according to my poll, about 60% of Americans do not know what jardinera or jardinere is. And even among the 40% that know what it is, most of them have a what I would describe as sort of a bastardized version of it. That
I'm scared. I said I did know what it is, and now I'm scared.
I
thought it was like pickled vegetables.
That
like
is
cauliflower.
Okay,
shit.
Yes, it is Italian kimchi. It is pickled peppers, onions, olives, vegetables, and it's kind of a chunky spread. You put out. Oh, holy shit! You put on.
You can get this Mazzetta. Mazzetta is the maker of my sport peppers.
You put it on a little. You put it on an Italian sandwich. You put it on an Italian beef. Oh my goodness.
You know what they would say? They'd say on the TV shows it adds nice acid.
Oh, it's kind of like ketchup. It's like sure, it's like you get a little sweetness, acid.
It brings it alive.
Oh my God, it's an amazing condiment. You put now listen to me. You put a little bit of this on a cheese pizza. You're next level. You get a thin crust pizza from Luminati's. You put a little jardinera on there. Oh baby, you got a stew going. But on the East Coast, what people call jardinera is what I would call hots, which is a different condiment. It's a different condiment. It's a red pepper sauce, almost like a sambal. It's almost like an Italian sambal.
It's a little bit, not like exactly like a sriracha, but like a spicy sauce.
But you can see the whole pepper seeds in it, you know, and it's sort of a goopy. It's more goopy. And yeah, it's not pickled. It is not a sort of spoonable pickled vegetable medley.
I love condiments.
Anyway, here's my point.
This is the most boring thing Chicago, I've ever heard in my life.
If you live in Chicago, please eat the Jardiniere. And if you're not from Chicago, stop. Don't think that eating hots at the diner at the, you know, the sandwich shop or whatever is the same as Jardiniere. You got to come to Chicago. You go to a bar. You get an Italian sandwich. You put the Jardiniere on there.
People think I'm bored when you guys talk politics. No. No.
Yeah, we're just describing things that have flavor, Alex. Yeah. Anyway, what was your challenge this week? Could you describe your challenge to us you picked?
The challenge that was proposed was make a suicide. And I'm like, no, what? But it is when you just mix a bunch of sodas together, or pop, or Coke, or whatever. Like, you go to a restaurant that has a bunch of fountain drinks that are accessible, which is hard to do in Chicago. Now in McDonald's, they keep, like, everything behind the counter because there's weirdos like me who will do this. But I'm sure people have seen this now. The challenge, we're calling it Pimp Your Drink. So
Make a Suicide. Suicide challenge.
No, it's weird. I didn't know what it was. It sounds weird. All right. So actually, I'm curious, Merlin, have you ever seen this? It kind of looks like an old style pop machine where you get a fountain drink, but there is a touch screen.
You're talking about the Coke Freestyle?
I guess that's what you could call it.
Shit, dog.
Yeah, the very first one in Chicago.
Designer
was that,
Amy and I tried to get one for our office.
Yeah. Oh, it's so hard.
Expensive and hard to maintain.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I bet that's a lot of maintenance.
Yeah, because there's a million like sacks of sugar in it. Then you have to make the proper.
Can you imagine those
mix?
Nozzles must get so jammed up?
Oh well, the touch screen is it's not pleasant. I mean, I'm sure like the traditional touching.
Look how filthy that thing is.
One time, my buddy Joe was talking to a crackhead in Baltimore, and he was like, who like lived on his block and habitated on his block, and he said to the crackhead, he was like, "How you doing, man?" And the guy went, "Man, I'm all jammed up." I just thought that was.
I know the feeling.
I just thought that was funny when you said it's all jammed up. I think of that in my head. Man, I'm all jammed up.
I'm all jammed up.
We say that to each other all the time. How you doing, man? Man, I'm all jammed up.
Before I get into my very compelling results, did either of you actually do this challenge?
Absolutely.
I'm going to do it live on air.
I'm also going to do part of it live on air.
I didn't realize we were doing a little three-ring circus here.
Well, the problem is there was no...
You got to make a drink.
All right. Well, I'm not doing mine on air, so I'm going to go first.
Go ahead.
I got scientific instruments.
So I traveled to Chicago's premier startup incubator, 1871.
Oh, God.
And there I sampled. I went with my friend Chris Deutsch, who is an investor in this thing called T-Bot. T-Bot. And I'm going to...
This sounds like a stupid thing that's in my wheelhouse.
I'm going to send you a little picture of this guy.
I already like that.
They're interested in... They had some interest in... He was like, I should like hook up the T-Bot people with your office. And I was like, Alex would probably be into this.
Yeah.
So basically what it is, hang on, I'm putting it in our super secret channel. Uh-oh. You can go to our show notes. Where do people find this picture in the show notes?
DubaiFriday.fm/77?
FM?
I think so.
It's DubaiFriday.com,
Oh,
guys.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the Simplecast one. Dubai. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Are you guys okay there? Is everything all right? You guys seem a little off your game today. Is everything all right?
Alex has lost her mind. I was just finding this picture. So check this thing out.
T-Bot.
So I sent you a picture.
My goodness.
So basically you order on
it's a live, you know, it's a live photo, Max.
Uh-oh, are my balls in this? No, you can see Chris's
so
hand.
Cool.
You can see Chris's hand.
That's your new name. Oh man, T-Balls is all jammed up.
I'm all jammed up. You can see Chris gesturing at this thing. All right, so basically, what happens, you order off this touchscreen, and up top, there's a hopper with, I think, like 12 or 16 different teas. And you can either just have it make a tea for you, or you can have it mix the teas. So I, in the spirit of our challenge, I mixed a tea which was gunpowder green tea with a herbal mint.
So basically, with mint, interesting.
So basically,
I was going to say like a jasmine with that.
Okay, that would be good too. But I don't know. I wanted to go a little crazy with it.
That gunpowder green is such a straight man, especially now, if you're all jammed up.
And now basically, the tea comes out of this big funnel contraption in the top, and then there's that little spigot on the bottom, and it pipes in water at the appropriate temperature. Now where I felt that this and you pay, you swipe your card and you pay. Now where I felt that the experience was a little lacking is basically what happens is you put your paper cup under these nozzles, and it actually just dumps the loose tea into your cup and then pours the water onto it.
No, no, no.
So what I was hoping was that it would actually hold the tea in a chamber, brew it, and then give you the finished filtered tea after it had brewed for the appropriate amount of time. But it just sort of dumps everything into your cup. And then I said to...
It's more like the bulk cereal thing at your cafeteria in college.
Exactly. The little trough of cereal.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, how do you not drink the tea leaves? And actually, they have these special filtered lids that you put on your paper cup. So it's like a plastic solo cup, like lid, basically. But it has a little...
But it just sits in there. Doesn't it get bitter sitting in there that whole time?
Yeah, so that was my other question I asked to Chris. I was like, well, isn't it going to over extract and get bitter if it's just loose hanging out in this hot pot of tea? And so basically what he recommends is you use the filtered lid to pour it into a second cup. So you brew your tea and then you pour into a second cup and then you drink from the second cup. And I was like, isn't that a little wasteful?
I don't think Shark Tank would invest in this.
Well, the design of that aside, like I used to be a big tea nerd, and that you can't just throw it all in and brew it at the same time. It just, I mean, maybe they have like
similar teas.
Well, it's
up to you
teas.
To control the time of the brew.
But that's the thing is like, what if you want to make a suicide tea and you can't mix your matcha and
also,
your blacks. Well,
I think Mark would not invest in this because you have burn issues. Couldn't you burn yourself on this?
Interesting.
Oh yeah, there is probably some sort of consumer safety issue. I mean, to me, where it's a great business is that they do the consumables too. So they like source the tea and send them to you and all of that. And
that's cool.
I don't know. And there is like a recipe functionality. So like you can actually like I could save my suicide on the machine and call it up next time. Like there is some sort of cool stuff that unlocks.
I
just think that they like fully. I was hoping in my heart would happen is that it would brew the tea and give me the brewed tea that was like made exactly right for like a true tea nerd, you know, standard. But that did not occur.
Was it good in any way?
It was delicious. Let me just say, like the tea in the machine was very high quality. I made a great cup of tea and I really enjoyed it and it was fun to use. I do feel like if you know a little bit less about tea than I do, that you would, like you said, Alex, you would just leave it in the cup and it would over extract. So I'm sort of glad that I knew that you had to do a little procedure, but I just wonder, like, in a cafeteria setting, would most people sort of know enough to, like, pour it from one cup into the other?
Oh, heck no. This is a very interesting little machine. I wish it had a face, but
they make
a
mini one, and I did. They said maybe they would bring it to, like, demo it out at our office or something like that.
Should I get my materials?
Yes.
Yes, please.
All right.
And I will. I did like a. I did a double ender, as they... No, I don't know. Just like that word. I went to this fountain thing, and I had my friend start putting beverages in. So they started with a Diet Coke, and I was drinking the Diet Coke. I'm like, okay, add another beverage. And then I would guess what sort of flavor they had put in. So then it was Diet Coke, then Cherry Coke, then Fanta, then Grape Fanta. But it seems like after five flavors, I can no longer tell what is in a suicide. And then my drink was almost no longer pimped. It was just a big, watery, sugary mess. So I'm wondering what the threshold for your flavors will be, Merlin. What's happening over there?
There's a lot going on. I'm responding to Kevin.
Mm. Who's Kevin?
Make sure she's adorable. Okay, it's very important that if we do the cat has to be adorable.
Well, did he? I said, cat? Why don't like Ellie gets
you,
the final
you
say?
You instructed me to send things to our design boy. I'm working with our design.
Oh, I understand what you're. Okay, I'm with you now. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't want to.
It's important that she be
talk
adorable.
About it on
okay.
the show,
we're
gonna, Merlin.
We're cutting. I'm editing.
All everything
this
that happens
very
on the show
heavy.
Is in the show.
All right, Merlin.
Well, I'm using my clicky cable because I had to move everything aside to make my goddamn drink. You guys made me.
God,
make.
God. All right.
God damn it.
Well, but while
I got a lot going on. Now I'm going to send you a photo of my desk with my materials, my dark materials on it.
Could you stream this it to us? Could you do some sort of Apple video call?
No.
Why
no.
not? Why not?
Can't do it. OPSEC.
Perhaps enliven
what are you
the photo.
About OPSEC? Just
no.
Just
no.
Call, do a
there
voice.
Can't be too much of a visual component to this show. People need to wonder.
But
people need to be
but
more
do,
curious.
But I'll paint a picture with words, Merlin. Mm. Do a FaceTime. I want to FaceTime you.
No. Mm-hmm.
FaceTime. FaceTime.
No. No. I'm no. 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 No.
So
I'm
going to
so FaceTime.
So you see
Merlin.
What I have before me. I'm going to take my classic suicide. Trigger warning for food. I'm going to take my classic suicide and I'm... what? No.
No, no, no FaceTime. No,
I want to watch the drinks get poured.
And you then can watch me pour my drinks. It's going to be more exciting.
Really?
Oh, the no,
Merlin looks so cranky.
Happy now, bitch. Okay, so what I have in front of me is the materials for...
Merlin picked up his phone and just looked so cranky.
my hair's all in disarray. I haven't done my hair and makeup. Okay, so I have before me. I have a Ziploc bag of ice. I have a 12-ounce can of Coke. I have a 7.5 fluid ounce can of Dr. Pepper. I have some lemon wedges. I have a 250-milliliter beaker and a pint glass, a British pint glass. And I'm going to make my classic suicide, trigger warning for food, but I'm going to try jazzing it up. Oh, I also got to get some seltzer. So here's what I do. I'm filling it to the top with ice. Now, I'm taking my beaker.
Cool.
I'm going to start.
Hold up. Hold back. Oh, I see. There is indeed a real beaker. Wow. Okay.
Okay, I'm going to start with... 150 milliliters of classic Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to add to that to start. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
About 50-ish milliliters of Dr. Pepper.
What was in the baggie?
Ice. What? And then lemon wedges.
Lemon wedges.
Now,
okay.
This is part of the magic.
What? Do you have a giant Coke can and a tiny Dr. Pepper can?
Isn't it adorable?
I like to call it cute size. Isn't it adorable?
Oh, it's a little mini Dr.
It's the perfect
Pepper.
Size. It's an old man size.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to add, this might overtop it, but I'm going to put in just under 100 milliliters of sparkling water.
Oh,
now, what
wow.
does that do?
Gives it extra zazz.
Mm.
And then I'm going to squirt in just a tiny bit of lemon.
Okay.
I mean, you're going
now,
above
you,
and
is
beyond.
Is this a drink you've had before, or did you sort of invent this for the podcast?
Well, there's probably a name for the Coke and Dr. Pepper. When I go to the movies, and sometimes it's fucking Mr. Pibb because these are different people. Mm. But what I'll do is I'll do 2/3 of the way Coke. What's funny, Alexandra?
No, Mr. Pibb is just a funny concept to me.
Hello. My father's Mr. Pibb. I will stir this with a Palomino Blackwing pencil.
Hmm. Eraser down or what are you going to drink? The
lead down,
eraser
lead
taste
down.
Or the lead taste? Okay, good.
And now here's my taste.
Okay.
Pretty good. Needs more Coke.
Mm.
Anyway.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. So when I go to the movies, I'll get a large drink, especially if they do free refills on a large. And I'll do about 2/3 Coke and about, depending if they have cherry Coke, I'll then top it off with half of the remainder will be Dr. Pepper. And about half will be cherry Coke. And that's a good-ass drink.
My big movie drink is I'll fill it about 90... Well, so first of all, you put about three ice cubes in there.
Then that's
whoa,
how they get you.
Then just the smallest number of ice cubes just to give it a little extra coldness. Then I'm going to fill it about 98% with Diet Coke. And then 1%, you're just going to quickly tap it, tap it right on the Lipton iced tea. You're going to get just a little bit of that lemony.
Oh,
just a little
sweetened?
Bit of a lemon.
Is it sweetened?
Yep.
Yeah, a little bit of a sweet lemon tea. Just a little lemon in the Diet Coke. Just one little blast of
I know a lot of people
lemon.
that once they say once you go, I'm not personally not a Diet Coke person. I've tried, but I've heard people say that if you're a Diet Coke person, you start putting lemon in, you never go back. That's what I heard.
Diet Coke and lemon is one of the great. Well, so my true passion in life is Diet Coke and lime, but that's not usually available.
At the Temkin household.
Well, yeah,
if I have to choose a juice, I'll always choose a lime over a lemon.
Diet Coke and lime is one of the great drinks.
It's a fascinating flavor. Well, and what's interesting is the can, it tastes like if there is actual lime in it, which kind of blew me away. And it's, how did they?
Oh, where's
the
taste
flavor?
There's a few fake flavors that humanity has just like made our bitch. And like lemon's our bitch. Like we can make anything taste like lemon. Banana's another one. Like I think we've really dominated banana. Like we can
make
anything. We're
really pegging these fruits.
We can make anything taste like banana. Lime.
The time they drag these fruits is everything.
Lime is definitely our bitch. I think a lot of the other berries, not really there. I love a raspberry candy. Does not have any relationship to the fruit that you eat.
Oh, yeah, like blue raspberry? That flavor is blue. The flavor is indeed blue.
The
flavor is called tangy.
Yeah. No one's more excited to eat a raspberry candy than I am, but it does. Mm-hmm. But it's not, has no bearing on. Coconut's another one. Like, boy, the gulf between a coconut sweet and eating a coconut is quite wide.
Mm. Oh, lightning and a lightning bug, all the difference. Mm.
I'm going to proceed with my, I'm not a huge LaCroix person, but I've gathered every flavor of LaCroix we have in the office and going to mix them all together just because I'm curious.
Oh my God.
What's
the Continental Breakfast sketch.
Continental Breakfast.
Right. We watch it every night. This. When he eats the banana is one of the great moments.
The banana.
It's one of the great moments of comedy.
Well, look at you, tiny plum. Oh, Danish.
It's so good.
The food's coming out of his mouth and he's just crying, it's so good. Every time I hear the phrase continental breakfast, I think of this.
Alex, this is very wasteful. Well, Alex has opened 6 cans of LaCroix
in front of her.
So it's
going to
be a combination of 6 kinds of things that don't really taste like anything.
Yeah, well, I've already assigned each of these cans to somebody who's going to drink it later, so it's not a waste. Although, I didn't realize there was a flavor, there's natural orange... And
tangerine.
Natural and tangerine.
Tangerine is better.
I'm aware that there's a difference between the fruits, but all right. So this is just one big clear glob.
Do you like LaCroix?
I do. Well,
it has flavor.
I prefer. That's the thing. Is like, why wouldn't I just drink regular water or regular
sparkling
water?
Yeah. Why would anyone have anything with flavor?
That's my main opinion about LaCroix.
Why wouldn't you just drink plain
flavor
water?
Flavor is not necessary to nutrition for Alex Bot.
Oh, this is interesting. It kind of mutes all the flavors.
Alex,
a little.
When you plug yourself into charge every night, there's no flavor involved in that.
There are no hesitation marks in my charge port. Meat loop, 80% power.